Just before we start today, are you a teacher? Most listeners aren't, because we aim this show at students. But if you are an educator of some form, I just wanted to let you know that I'm co-authoring a special series this month on effective studying with this week's podcast guest, Peps McRae, for his famous ultra-concise, ultra-high-value Evidence Snacks email newsletter. In the three-part series we've put together, I'm sharing some of my all-time favourite tips and tricks that I've learned over the years to help embed smarter study strategies in your school, helping students study smarter, not harder, going beyond the research recommendations to figure out exactly what we need to be telling students to help them put good ideas into practice. In the email series, I'm even giving away some of my teaching resources so you can pick up some ready-to-teach lessons so you can deliver these ideas directly into your school. So you get slides, a little video, and even a workbook for your learners. Follow the link in the episode description to catch up on any emails in the series that you might have missed so far, and then sign up to Peps's Evidence Snacks email list to get the rest of the series delivered directly to your inbox. For everyone else listening, all my non-teacher friends studying hard for their exams at school, university and more, I just wanted to say, especially if your exams are coming up soon over the next few weeks, hang in there, my friends, keep going, you've got this. And now, here's today's episode.
Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you ace your exams at school and university through the psychology of high performance and the science of studying smarter, not harder. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the Cambridge-trained memory psychologist and exam success coach, William Wadsworth!
Hello and welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast. Today I've got a fascinating conversation for you with Dr. Matthew Zakreski, who's a real expert in the world of neurodivergence and mental health. It will be quickly apparent to you as we get into today's conversation that Dr. Matt is the real deal. He really, really knows his stuff and shares some fascinating brain science, as well as lots of practical advice. There are three main reasons I would encourage anyone to listen to today's episode. First, you already know or think you might have some form of neurodivergence, ADHD, autism, OCD, dyslexia, even giftedness, which is a brand new topic for us on the podcast. I'm excited to open that box as part of today's episode. In each case, Dr. Matt has some great advice on how to effectively advocate for yourself, or if you're a parent, how to advocate for your son or daughter so that you can get the right support that you need. Second, you may have a neurodivergent brain, but not have realised it yet. That's very common, particularly among adults. And once we recognise that, we can unlock a better understanding of the gifts and challenges that come with each condition so that we can better mitigate the challenges and then lean into and maximise the potential of the strengths that are associated with your particular form of neurodivergence. And then finally, even if you're the most neurotypical person out there, you will develop a better understanding of those around you, in your friendship circles, in your family, or if you're an educator, of the students in your charge, and thereby be able to be a better friend, parent, mentor, or teacher as appropriate. So I'm really looking forward to today's episode. Let's meet Dr. Matt and dive right in.
My name is Dr. Matt Zakreski, and I am a clinical psychologist who specializes in working with neurodivergent folks or people with different brains.
Dr. Matt, a very warm welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. What would you love listeners to take away from this episode?
You know, I'm lucky enough to be on a lot of podcasts, and people ask me that question, and I feel like my answer shifts sometimes, but it always comes back to, if we understand our brains, then we understand what to do with them. And when we understand what to do with our brains, we tend to do better and then we feel better. So if you take a little knowledge away and that turns into some better strategies, then I've done my job.
Tell us about this theme of, you know, us all having different brains, or perhaps, I don't know if you'd consider some brains to be more different than others, or whether that's a fair way of phrasing it. But yeah, maybe just kind of give us a perspective on, you know, the background of sort of this topic of neurodiversity generally, like how do you define it and why is it so important to be talking about it?
So, you know, there are three words we need to know. The first is neurodiversity. Neurodiversity is all brains, right? So if you are walking down the street, everyone you see is part of broader neurodiversity. Neurodivergent is a brain that is different than the norm. And in this case, we'll use the word neurotypical for the norm. So about 70% of people are neurotypical, right? Their brains largely fit within expected parameters, right? And there's certainly individual differences between that, but largely speaking, they stick together. On the neurodivergent side, it's brains that are structurally and quantifiably different. Brains that I could look at a brain scan and say, ah, yes, that brain works differently than the other brains. And those differences have names like dyslexia, ADHD, autism, giftedness, OCD, dyspraxia. And this shift is a relatively new and vitally important change in how we talk about these brain differences, because you'll notice we're not talking about, like, you know, mental illness here. We're talking about literal brain differences, right? You might be tall, I might be short. We're both have a certain amount of height, right? So this is a major shift, and it's really important for people to understand that the differences you feel as a neurodivergent person, or the differences you feel someone who's bopping around the universe who doesn't know quite yet that they're neurodivergent, there's a term for this, and that all comes back to brain differences.
So why is it helpful for a given individual who might be neurodivergent to be able to better understand their form of neurodivergency and kind of what it means for them? Like, what does that, how does that kind of empower that individual in their life?
So the phrase I often use here, and I will adapt it for our wonderful UK listeners, that it's better to know that you're a zebra, not a weird horse. Did I say that right? Zebra, right?
You'd normally say zebra.
Yes. Right? You know, we say zebra here.
Don't worry about it too much. We have more listeners in the US than we do in the UK. I'm from the UK, but not all of our listeners are.
You know, the stripy horse looking thing, guys. It's fine.
We got it.
Love it. And that's, I mean, it's so important to understand this, because in the absence of information, our brains create our own narratives. Those narratives tend to center ourselves in the story and tend to be catastrophic. So if you're someone who's sitting there in a lecture hall, unable to pay attention to the teacher, and everyone else is scribbling notes and focused, and you're like, what is wrong with me?
Yes.
Think about that word. What is wrong with me? It's not, why is my brain different? It's not, does this environment suit me? It's, I am somehow lacking. You know, I mean, the difference between knowing you're a zebra and a weird horse is that, you know, zebras need different things than horses do, right? They might look the same, they might run the same, but you can adapt what the environment and interventions look like for a zebra, and that helps the zebra do better. And that's really what all of this is about.
Yeah. You just reminded me of the story of the ugly duckling. Like, you're not an ugly duckling. You're a perfectly normal swan. But if you're comparing yourself to the standards of other ducklings, you're going to look a bit odd by comparison.
Absolutely. And the world is built for those ducklings, right?
I 70%.
Mean, yeah, 70%. And it really makes sense to set up jobs and school and airports and pubs for neurotypical people, because there's a lot more of them than there are of us, right? If I was logically creating a system, I'd say, you know, okay, the most people need this thing, so I'm going to do this. But then we can't stop the conversation there, right? If you're having a barbecue and you know most people like hamburgers, you might cook more hamburgers, but you want to have some veggie dogs, and you want to have some chicken, and you want to have, you know, some quinoa burgers, right? Just to accommodate the people who are on the other ends of that broader spectrum, right? And that's where we need to really push up the advocacy, because if there aren't normalized options, what people try to do is choke down hamburgers if they can't eat them. And then the cook wonders, well, why don't you like my food, right? It's like, well, no, it's just like, I just can't eat it. Right. I mean, I would do much better if you gave me a veggie burger. And then, you know, then it turns into a narrative of like, oh, you're so picky, kids these days. Right. So, you know, it's so important that we anchor this conversation is that these things aren't choices. They are literal brain differences. And when you put different brains in environments that are built for them, they do a lot better.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'd love to get into talking a little bit about some of the kind of adjustments and accommodations you might consider for different things in a moment. And you reeled off a list of some of the common neurodivergencies a moment ago, ADHD, OCD, autism. I wonder if you could just maybe talk us through that list just to sort of shade more slowly and just sort of explain what each one of those things is for anyone listening that isn't familiar with those terms.
For sure. All right. So let's start with ADHD, right? That's a good place to start. So ADHD is a neurodevelopmental condition where the prefrontal cortex, the front part of your brain, develops more slowly. And that part of your brain handles our executive functioning skills, time management, sustained attention, organization. And there's this common perception that ADHD is the kid who's like, squirrel!
Sure.
Right? And yes, it can show up that way. But most of the time, what ADHD really feels like for people is like trying to carry water in a bucket that has a hole in it. Nobody else's bucket has a hole in it. Why does my bucket have a hole in it? And why do I have less water than other people? And ADHD can show up as hyperactive type. So you're running around the room, inattentive type, head in the clouds, daydreaming, or a combination of the two. Now, the inattentive type is a lot harder to see because if you're sitting there in class and your hands are folded and you're looking at the teacher, but in your head, you're playing, the Mines of Mordor, like you're not here. You might be physically here, but mentally, you know, you're with Legolas charging into the deep. But the teacher's not going to necessarily notice that until you fail the test. And then they say, oh, well, what's going on here? Right. So that's ADHD. And that part of the brain, it's like a muscle. The more you work it, the stronger it gets. Right. So ADHD is not a life sentence. You can come up with strategies and skills to strengthen that part of your brain. But we also need to understand that it's a part of the brain that's going to need support for a long time. Next thing we have is autism. Autism is just a giant grab bag of neurodevelopmental conditions, usually demonstrated by difficulties in social interaction, difficulties in emotional expression, and difficulties in stereotyped or repetitive behaviors. We're taking a very wide range of things and cramming it into one thing. We could talk about the differences in autism for the whole rest of the podcast. And, there's an expression in the autism field that if you've met one kid with autism, you've met one kid with autism. And I think that broadly speaks for neurodivergent kids in general. You know, I've worked with autistic individuals who are very well lower than expected on the IQ spectrum with significant impairments. I've also worked with autistic individuals who IQs are in the 180s and hold major high-level positions. So, autism is not a direction to go in one way to only have one kind of life. With the right accommodations and support, an autistic individual can do basically anything. And I think understanding autism as a piece of neurodivergence is important for everyone to understand because it's like, this is a different brain. This isn't the parents' fault. This isn't too much television or TikTok or whatever we're blaming these days. Right. It literally is this brain works differently. But if you put that brain in accommodations that help it work to its potential, then really there's no limit to what anybody can do. Right. And that's why this work is so important, because we're really trying to understand that, hey, if we support these people, they can do anything. Right. That's a nice dovetail into OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder is seen more as a mental illness because it can be so dysregulating and impactful. But really there's a circuit in the brain called the basal ganglia. And that circuit is basically the reward system of our brain, right? It's like, I have a task. I do the task. I feel good that I did the task. The end. When you have an OCD brain, that system is supercharged. So you need to do the task, you feel a lot of anxiety and dread that you haven't done the task. And since the basal ganglia is so close to the limbic system, the emotional center of our brain, not doing the task feels incredibly emotionally dysregulating, right? It's like, I'm upset. I feel like I'm in danger. I worked with a young man once upon a time who had to do everything in nines, you know, flip the light switch on and off 9 times, put on his shoes 9 times, put on a shirt 9 times, drink 9 times before he had a sip of water. And he genuinely believed if he didn't do it in nines, he'd die. His heart would stop. And so it's the sort of thing, like, that part of the brain was supercharged and essentially became like malignant, right? It became really disruptive. He couldn't leave his house without a lot of effort and a lot of work. He would show up to my office drenched in sweat because it took him so long to do all the things that people like you and I take for granted. Like, I put on my shoes and I left my house. That's a 20-minute process for him, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, with good therapy and good medication, you know, we were able to really make some positive changes. But the thing that really changed it for him was understanding that it was a brain difference, that we could point to his brain on an fMRI and say, that's how your basal ganglia works. This is what a neurotypical basal ganglia does. And he could see the difference, right? It's like, oh, okay, this isn't somehow my fault, right? This isn't somehow my father's fault because he wiped my bottom too hard when I was 6 months old. Like, this is absolutely a brain difference that has grown into something very debilitating in my adult life. Dyslexia is, it's commonly associated in challenges with reading. And reading is a very neurologically complex task. You look at some shapes. The shapes have meaning that you've learned. You translate that meaning in your brain, and then you say that meaning out loud. Yeah, I mean, reading is a miracle. Like, it's absolutely a miracle. And for kids who struggle with it, it can be really shaming because in the Western culture, a lot of what we do in education settings, but also in workplace settings, involves reading. You know, I work with a young man who's dyslexic and has a 168 IQ. He's an incredible math student, but he runs into problems because the math problems he has to solve are written at a college level. And he's dyslexic. He really struggles with those words. And, you know, the school saying, well, he's brilliant. He should be able to do the math. I was like, he can do the math. He can't read it. It's a different skill. You know, I said, if you just told him, I don't know math well enough to even give you a theoretical example, right? But something math, 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 cosine, he could do it, right? But it's the reading part. So kids with dyslexia end up developing a lot of skills to navigate the world. Dyslexic kids tend to be very creative. They tend to be really good problem solvers. They're good at thinking on their feet. They're good at picking up information from their environments because, A, their brains are wired that way, but also life sort of points them in that direction. Because if you can't read the sign, you look at your environment for those cues to tell you what the sign might say. And then you can make an educated guess based off that. And then last but not least is something that's near and dear to my heart, which is the idea of giftedness. Now, giftedness is a little bit better understood here in the US than it is in the UK. But as someone who grew up as a gifted kid, it was all about, well, look how smart you are. You're very smart. You're going to go to Harvard or Oxford, right? You know, I want to be inclusive.
Well, the Sorbonne. I don't think we've got too many listeners in France. But
you know, Trinity College. I want to see the book at the calendar.
Sure. You know?
But really, it's about brain differences. And one of the things that comes with being gifted, just to name one of the brain differences, is there are more neural connections, right? So synapses are the neurons that our brain is made of neurons, which are nerve cells in our brain, and where they connect is called a synapse. There are more neurons in our brain that are stronger, right? So it's not local roads, it's superhighways, So we can literally look at brain differences in the gifted brain and say, this is a brain that not only works harder, but also works more efficiently, right? Problem is that one of the things that comes with having a gifted brain is a weaker prefrontal cortex. So, you know, you might say that it's the engine of a 2024 Aston Martin, but the brake system of a 1988 Gremlin. It's just not a good combination, right? It's a bad fit. So you've got kids who get up to incredible rates of speed, but can't always slow down to read the stop signs. And that's how they get into trouble. You know, I've got kids who, you know, the teacher asks a question before the teacher's even done asking the question, the kid's shouting out the answer, right? Which irritates the teacher, irritates their classmates. And the kid will say to me, but I knew the answer, so I said it. Like, why am I in trouble? It's a balance, right? You can teach kids the skills they need to survive that classroom and also help their teachers, coaches, adults understand that this is just how this kid's brain works.
This may go absolutely nowhere, but I'm fascinated. So weaker prefrontal cortex, one of the prefrontal cortex functions is working memory. So your brain's ability to kind of hold and kind of your capacity to kind of hold onto information and like manipulate it in the present moment. So my own sort of background, I grew up and I, you know, was reasonably kind of bright kid at school. You know, I did really well at school exams, and I don't know, you know, the label of gifted, you know, gifted might apply to me, I'm not sure. But one of the things that I always struggled to square was the fact that whenever I did sort of these kind of working memory type tests, I was hopeless at it. Like, you know, definitely below average working memory, and, you know, not very good at sort of games that involved that kind of skill. Or, you know, when I studied psychology, you know, I wasn't very good at those kind of classic working memory tests. And I always put it down to I was having a bad day or whatever. And in later years, I've started to realize that I probably do have below average working memory, but I sort of feel I compensate for that in other ways. And, you know, I've got an unusually good ability to kind of come up with strategies and systems to sort of, you know, work around that. And actually, I think, you know, in hindsight, and I've only realized this quite recently, I think a lot of what I teach now in terms of study strategy, particularly some of the exam hall strategies I teach, are, you know, as a result of having slightly weaker working memory, perhaps, and they've sort of had to come up with all these strategies and to kind of perform at the level I wanted to perform at in my own academic journey. I wondered what your perspective was on all of that.
Well, you're 100% right. And normally when we do IQ tests, right, IQ tests, I'll oversimplify a little bit. There are four major components, right? Verbal IQ, nonverbal IQ, working memory, and processing speed. Those are the four things that we've decided as a Western society, that's what makes up intelligence. When you test gifted kids, this is common enough that in the literature, it's called the ski slope, because it starts really high in verbal and nonverbal skill and then goes down to working memory and down to processing speed. The gifted brain works very well, but it only has one gear. Right? So if you don't know the answer immediately, your brain's like, well, now what? And it can sort of just stall out, like give you the blue screen of death. Mm-hmm. And with the amount of information flying around our brains, our working memory is impacted, because working memory has a very limited capacity. 7 pieces of information plus or minus 2. Your average phone number is longer than our working memory can handle. Right? At least here in the US, most phone numbers are 10 digits. Yeah. Right? So if I give you my phone number and people are like, I got the first 2, I didn't get the middle, and I got the last 2. And that's what most people say, right? So you come up with strategies that help you do that. One of the ways that we can connect the neuroscience of neurodivergence to that learning process is telling kids, hey, if you can get it into your long-term memory, into your hippocampus, it'll stay there forever, right? You have a very strong hippocampus, but that working memory piece of executive functioning is a little weaker. So you've got to help it down the road till it gets to the place, and then it'll stay there, right? So we come up with strategies. You know, my wife will, when she sends me to the grocery store, she'll tell me things, and then she'll text me what the list is. Yeah. Not because I don't want to remember it, but because I will inevitably remember 75% of it, and the two most important things I will forget. So now I have a thing that I can return to and say, ah, there it is. I was supposed to get eggs and milk and cheese and bread and oranges. Okay, well, I would not have remembered the oranges. So those are little everyday strategies that we can layer in. And if it comes from a place of understanding how your brain works, worst case scenario, you feel less bad about yourself. Best case scenario, it empowers you because you're like, yeah, my brain needs some help in this. But once I get it, woo, I'll know it forever. And this is where things like study strategies come in, like changing the name of things or finding some sort of personal connection to them, can really whip you through the working memory process right into long-term storage. And once it's long-term storage, I mean, you know, it's going to hang out for a long time.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. I should just say thank you so much for the incredibly insightful set of kind of brief introductions you've given us over the last 10 minutes to these various neurodivergences. Such a fantastic summary. And I love the kind of both the, you know, the real world kind of experience you shared of kind of what it will feel like for people, plus the kind of understanding of what's actually going on in the brain and why that brain is different. Just a really, really fascinating summary. So thank you for that. Just one observation I'd kind of share based on some of the things we've been talking about. It's not necessarily that a particular condition is good or bad. Like, no one is kind of all good or all bad, I think. Like, reading down that list, you might think that final one, like giftedness, oh, well, that's a good one. But as you were talking about, like, there are advantages and disadvantages to the way that particular type of brain will work. And on a personal level, that's really interesting for me. And that's something I'll probably go and be doing some more research on. But then all the others as well, so ADHD, autism, OCD, dyslexia, you know, in dyslexia, for example, you're talking about some of the kind of advantages of having a brain that works in that way. And, you know, you might typically be kind of more creative. And there's some, you know, no one is all good or bad. There are pros and cons of each, and understanding both your challenges so you can mitigate them, and understanding your strengths so you can play into them, I guess is a pretty powerful thing to be able to do.
I mean, absolutely. And you summed it up beautifully. The whole heart of the neurodiversity movement is that differences aren't deficits, right? And I think this is really important because there for a while, a lot of people were trying to push this narrative that like ADHD is a superpower. Like, I'm autistic. What's your superpower? And listen, there are parts of neurodivergence that make your life easier, and that's awesome. But we can't ignore the parts that make it harder, right? I mean, I'm gifted and I have ADHD, and my ADHD has made me a better stand-up comedian. It's made me better at improv. I think sometimes it makes me a better parent. Also, it's made a lot of tests harder. It makes doing my taxes, like rip my hair out, difficult, right? When our kids were younger and you had to have the diaper bag and the other bag and the other bag and the stroller, I often forgot stuff like that. You know, differences aren't deficits, nor are they superpowers, right? When you meet people where they are, you give them the best platform to move forward in the way that feels best and works best for them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know this is going to be a difficult question because the whole point of divergency is there's lots of difference out there and there'll be a whole myriad of different things that will help different people. But I wonder if you could maybe just talk to, you know, in sort of general terms, like, you know, if you are a student or a learner with a kind of neurodivergence or you're the parent of one, what are some of the challenges and, you know, potential kind of solutions for kind of advocating for yourself effectively?
Absolutely. Well, and ironically, to make it easier for you, you need to make the coursework harder. There's a concept in psychology called the Yerkes-Dodson Law. And the Yerkes-Dodson Law says that when things are too easy, we don't engage. When they're too hard, we can't engage. Think about a brilliant student in maths in fourth grade, right? This kid is absolutely brilliant and he wants to do harder stuff. And the teacher says, no, you need to learn what everybody else is learning. But the kid's already mastered addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. He wants to move on to algebra. And the teacher says, no, no, no. So the kid stops trying, starts getting worse grades, thus proving, giant air quotes, that they're not that smart. You know, and then the kid gives up on the system. So to really engage our brightest kids, you need to level set. You need to put them at the level that's going to challenge them the right amount. You know, too hard, we can't do it. Too easy, we won't do it. And you can imagine, like, think about that in your own life. You know, whether it's cooking or working out or reading a book, things that are too easy, you're like, well, I don't want to do this. Things that are too hard, you're like, why would I even try? Right? It's that middle ground. It's that what I call the leading edge of learning. That's where we want to put people. Then we tie that into giving kids a lot of choice around how they engage with their academic work. You know, one of the simplest accommodations to give a student, and I ask all my students to advocate for this with their teachers, is to have some choice over the product they make on the thing they learn. So, for instance, right, you know, when you study psychology, I'm going to guess that most of your assessments were tests or papers. Is that a reasonable assumption?
Yeah, definitely.
And did that work for you as a student?
I never really thought to question it, if I'm quite honest. I mean, I liked writing. I was perfectly competent at writing. So the written work was fine. And I'd always done quite well in exams. Like, you know, that was always something, a challenge I always sort of rose to. It was all right for me. But I suppose I never thought to think whether there was another way that could be more preferable.
Right. And that is a sign of someone who can largely fit into the system, which is awesome. Like, good for you. And I was good at taking tests too. But if I had my choice, I would have always rather they were written a paper, because I can just vomit out some words and call it a day. And then in graduate school, they would say, hey, do you want to do a project on this instead of writing a paper, instead of taking a test? I'm like, I can do a project? I can be creative. I could do a presentation or record a podcast or do some drawing. And absolutely, I wanted to do those things. And this isn't letting kids off the hook, because you can hold them to a very high academic standard through the project-based learning, but kids remember it more. They engage in it better. So one of the things, it's another sort of paradoxical intervention for study skills, but if you're someone who can't just cram a bunch of facts into your brain to take a test, why not give that kid the ability to write a paper or do a project? They're going to learn the same stuff, but if you learn it in a way that you have to apply that knowledge to write a paper or do a project, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that you'll actually learn it better and hold on to it longer. You know, I mean, one of the things that's big in the U.S. educational system is that they want us to know all the capitals of all 50 states. They're very big on that, right? They're like, do the thing, you know. And I could never remember the capital of Kentucky. It's Frankfort, by the way, just in case you wanted to know. You probably don't.
Good to know.
Put that in your list of things you should know. Except until I went to Frankfort to do a conference, and I found it to be a very charming town filled with good people. So now when I'm like, oh, what's the capital of Kentucky? My brain goes, Frankfurt. Do you remember that barbecue restaurant you ate in Frankfurt? I'm like, of course I do. I made it personal, right? So it's not just an abstract fact. It's a way that I connected personally. And when I was doing my presentation there, I looked up some facts about Frankfurt to enhance my presentation, right? And thus used it in that presentation. And I guarantee you, I know more about Frankfurt than I ever would have learned if all I ever had to do was regurgitate it for a test in grade 6, right? So we need to give kids opportunities to engage deeply, to put it through the lens of how they like to learn, how they like to express their learning. Then everybody learns better and everybody does better. And there's no downside to this.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I like that point. I mean, I think that's a great idea. I suppose my next question is, if we fail in our mission to do that, so here in the UK, you might have a hard job convincing one of the major public exam boards to let you deliver a presentation rather than turn up and sit your GCSE exams or your A-level exams, the kind of the big equivalent of like SATs or something in the US. So if you do have to turn up and sit an exam and it's not your natural environment, you know, what are some of the common things that people might think about in terms of accommodations? I know, you know, for example, off the top of my head, you know, extra time is quite a common one I hear people talking about, or, you know, possibly being able to use a laptop if you have dyslexia. Yeah, what are your thoughts on surviving the exam process?
Extra time is always a lovely thing. And what the research shows is a lot of kids with extra time don't actually use it. It's knowing you have it is a really lovely thing. If you're someone who's very environmentally sensitive, a lot of neurodivergences come with a lot of sensory sensitivity. There's a kid I work with. She's very sensitive to the noise that fluorescent lights make. That's sort of like terrible noise. I hate that noise, but I can tune it out. She can. So we literally found a room in her school where she can take tests by a regular desk lamp, and that works for her. And you know, the school was like, oh, I don't know if we should let her do this. I'm like, for the rest of us, this is like trying to take a test while sitting on a chair that was sharp, right? You can't settle your body. So how are you going to learn? And I got the real world's not going to accommodate that. I'm like, actually, she could very much pick a university that doesn't have fluorescent lights, or a job that she can work from home and choose her own lights. Infinite number of choices, right? For a long time, we'd say like these neurodivergences, quote unquote, got better after kids finished public school, right? After grade 12, after the end of high school. But the more I spend time around people, the more I realize it's not that they got better. It's just that you have so much more choice as an adult in what you engage in, how you dress, what you eat, what you do. You're not being dragged to 9 hours of compulsory education in classes you didn't get to pick, right? So when you get more choice, like I don't like wearing neckties, so I don't wear neckties anymore, right? I used to have a job where I had to wear a tie. I hated it. Yeah. Right now, it's like, hey, all right, I'm still wearing a work shirt. I still look nice enough, but you know, and I'm sitting in a chair that feels comfortable for me. Like those sensory accommodations are a big thing. So choosing the room in which you take a test matters. That might be a private room. That might be a room with low lighting. We can figure that out. Extra time. I'd also put in there, one of the things that gifted people in particular, but really all neurodivergent folks will say is, I can do it, so I should. And to that, I usually respond, just because you can carry it doesn't mean it's not heavy. You know, if you have 100 energy points to take a test, and you have to spend 70 of those energy points handwriting something because writing does not come easy to you. Maybe it's a fine motor skill delay. Maybe it's dysgraphia. Then giving that kid a computer to type their answer takes that 70 points and makes it 10 points. That's 60 points of energy you got back to take the rest of the test. We wonder why our kids are exhausted and burnt out is we're making them work hard, not smart, right? Because that's how we do it here at Wellington Ford Prep Academy, right? Or whatever we might be at. And it's so easy to give a kid a laptop and just say, like, look, I turned off the Wi-Fi. You can't look up the answers. And the kid goes, great. Type, 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 done. And I'm going to bang that drum until they, you know, either listen to me or throw me in jail. I don't know. But it's just such an obvious solution, because I don't want kids to have to work harder than they have to at something that's already difficult.
You touched on I presume this comes up quite a bit in your work, sort of, you know, the suggestions you might make initially meet with some resistance from the institution in question. And you modeled quite nicely an example of sort of overcoming that resistance and sort of being persistent. I just wondered if you could share any kind of inspiring messages, I suppose, for anyone in the same position or trying to advocate either for themselves or for a child of theirs and encountering a bit of initial resistance.
One of the things that has been really helpful is advocacy for a child almost always becomes about that child. Johnny needs these things. Sally needs these things. But when you can talk about that stuff as part of brain science and this broader neurodiversity movement, right? You're seeing neurodiversity show up as a DEI work, right? That's awesome. That makes me so happy. You're seeing neurodiversity show up in education classes and psychology classes, right? That means that we are starting to reach this critical mass of understanding, because once people understand it, then we don't have to do as much hard work to get them to the baseline of understanding. You know, if I start with a shared knowledge, you know this stuff, I know this stuff, let's work within that knowledge to help this kid, then my job gets easier. If I need to spend a month educating you to get up to a point where you could even start to help, I'll still do that because it's vital you understand it. Because that's when it goes past not just helping Johnny, but helping every other Johnny in the school and every other Johnny that's going to come after Johnny, right?
Yes.
And then when I do my job well, inevitably the adult I'm talking to goes, oh my God, we've had so many kids like this. We've had so many kids like this. We didn't know. And I'm like, of course you didn't, because this is relatively new science and it's slowly making its way out there. And, you know, if I may quote the great Maya Angelou, right? Do as well as you can until you know better, and then do better, right? I'm not going to shame somebody for what they didn't know. I'm going to teach them that and then hold them to a high standard. That's what I do, right? And if you're out there advocating for your kid, then it's helpful to tap into somebody like me. And there's a lot of people out there who do what I do to help you in that advocacy education journey, because it makes your argument a little bit stronger. It adds a little gravitas because I do have the doctor in front of my name, right? But it's more just content knowledge, right? I always share my PowerPoints and my presentations with families because I want them to know what I know. I want them to pass that on to their principals, school psychologists, counselors, teachers, coaches, musician directors, whatever it is. Hey, here's how my kid's brain works. Please make some accommodations based off this thing. Not just me saying Sally needs this, saying this research shows that kids like Sally need this. That makes our argument a little bit better. It adds some heft to it.
Yeah. Yeah. This has been such a fantastic conversation. I just wondered if you had any final messages for listeners that you feel would be useful to share.
The final message is, let's turn up the volume on something we've already said, right? There's absolutely no shame in not knowing, right? It's only shameful if you become willfully ignorant, like, nope, ADHD doesn't exist, la, 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 right? So if you hear this and you're like, gosh, I've always sort of wondered why I was different and weird, maybe it's one of these things. One of the things our brains do to keep us from changing is our brains will like, well, I should have started this 10 years ago. Well, probably. But if you didn't start it 10 years ago, the next best time to start is right now. So if it starts with this podcast, then welcome to the club. We're happy to have you. You know, we meet on Tuesdays. It's going to be great. Yeah. But it's that sort of thing. Like, there is no shame in not knowing. But if you do know, or this planted a seed or lit a spark, then there's a lot of information out there. There are professionals, there are podcasts, there are conferences, there's a lot of great books. Do yourself a favor and dive in, right? Because the more you know, the more you're going to be able to be the best zebra you can be. And not that they're wondering why you're a weird horse.
Incredible. Where do we go to find out more about you and your work if we're inspired to carry on the conversation?
I have two major online presences. The first is my therapy practice, the neurodiversitycollective.com. We are a wonderful, strong team of clinicians and coaches and therapists who work with neurodivergent folks all over the country. We have a really good team. And as I do more of this stuff, it's becoming more common for people ask me to come and speak to them directly. So presenting at a school, presenting at a conference, which don't get me wrong, I love to do. So that's drmattsokreski.com. I'm very Googleable. I have a very unique name. So if you just punch my name into Google, I'll come up. And then you send me a message and I will see how I can help. You know, you're not in this journey alone. And if I'm the person who can help you, whether it's your family, your kiddo, your organization, your company, your university, well, we've got the tools and the skills to make those changes no matter what comes across.
Incredible. Well, look, thank you once again. This has been such an excellent conversation. I've really, really enjoyed this and taken a lot away from it myself as well. So thank you so much again for being so generous with your wisdom and your expertise and sharing that with us today. And thanks again. Well, thanks again, Dr. Matt. And if you've enjoyed today's episode and you know someone who might benefit from hearing it, perhaps take a moment to share the episode with them. In any podcast app, there'll be a little share button and you can share it via a WhatsApp message or via a social media link or via an email. It might be a friend, a family member, a teacher, or if you are a teacher yourself, perhaps some of your students or even colleagues. For neurodivergent listeners, sharing this episode with a key person in your life, perhaps a teacher, or if you're in education yourself, could be a great way to begin or further the conversation about the best ways to help you thrive. You might also like to check out previous episodes we've done on similar subjects, in particular number 113 on dyslexia, number 114 on ADHD, and number 115 on autism. These may be useful next stops if you want to go deeper on any of those. Otherwise, thank you so much for listening today. Really enjoyed your company as always, and I look forward to seeing you again soon. For now, wishing you every success in your studies.
Wasn't that wonderful? If you're feeling inspired, why not leave us a rating and a review in your podcast app? It would make our day. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.